Well, the solution is simple. Make them take out their units, their people, and their weapons, and the war ends. The morning and evening inspections were essentially opportunities for violence. It was a statistical certainty that during these roll calls, you would receive 5, 10, or 15 blows with clubs or boots, depending entirely on the mood of the shift. You are completely isolated inside a small concrete office with 2 or 3 interrogators, a special forces handler, sometimes a guard dog, and an array of compliance tools, industrial stun guns, heavy rubber batons, mallets, metal pipes, bare electrical wiring, water buckets, handcuffs, and hoods. I have a deep scar right here on my face. That is a literal chunk taken out of me by a guard dog they set on me.
That scar right near your eye, that's from a dog attack during an interrogation?
Yes, it was in Kursk. Without a doubt, the complete dissolution of the Russian Federation into a multitude of small, independent, sovereign states and republics. Let them compete, balkanize, and fight among themselves if they must.
Welcome to the True War Crimes Podcast. Each story we share here offers a unique glimpse into the darkest corners of the Russian Federation. These are places you will never, or at least I sincerely hope you will never, have to see, experience, or visit yourself. But through conversations with those who have been there, you can form your own understanding of what truly happens within Russia's darkest depths. Today we are discussing this with Yulian Pilipay, a close friend of mine. We have traveled extensively abroad together and participated in joint advocacy meetings. If I'm not mistaken, we last saw each other late last year in the Netherlands. A lot of time has passed since then, and a great job was done by our militaries. Taking this opportunity, Yulian, as of right now, you are technically still a service member.
Yes, technically.
So, as you are still in active service, before we dive into the core of your story about captivity, tell me, do you follow the battlefield and current trends? Do you notice any patterns? Where do you think this is all heading?
Hello, everyone. Absolutely, I follow it closely. I am in constant contact with my friends, many of whom are now battalion commanders, brigade commanders, deputy brigade commanders, as well as ordinary soldiers and sergeants. We talk regularly, and I closely monitor the situation. To me, what's happening is quite expected. The trend is very straightforward. First of all, things are tough for us, but they were just as tough 4 years ago. That is vital to understand. Secondly, this isn't just an isolated incident. It's a distinct trend showing a slowdown in the offensive operations of all Russian forces across the entire line of contact, without singling out any specific direction. This slowdown is driven by a series of decisions, actions, and systemic problems within Russia and the Russian military as a whole.
Okay. What are your thoughts on the recent mid-range and deep strikes?
They are magnificent. You know, in military planning, regardless of the operation, timing is everything. In my opinion, this is incredibly timely, coming at a moment when both sides are heavily exhausted. Delivering such painful punches, they are highly visible, and their impact becomes apparent very quickly. This is undoubtedly a massive positive. The main challenge will be maintaining this momentum, which won't be easy. However, I believe we will manage to sustain the pace and bring this to its logical progression and conclusion.
You know, it brings back memories of 2022, 2023, and even 2024, when we desperately needed assets capable of reaching mid-range and deep targets. Our international partners heavily limited those capabilities for us. And look, we developed our own drones, and now we can execute these operations independently. It's not that we aren't grateful, we are incredibly thankful for all the aid. But had we been given these tools back then, this war might very well be over by now.
Perhaps, but today we have assets from both our partners and our own production. And here credit must be given to Ukraine and its people. We do not give up, we fight on. Most importantly, it comes down to ingenuity. We always find a way to innovate.
Exactly. And looking at those narratives on some European websites, I occasionally browse through them, or someone forwards them to me because they know we work on countering disinformation. They constantly blast claims that Ukraine is losing, that Ukraine can never win under any circumstances. Frankly, it's the same recycled narrative for the fifth consecutive year, and they still expect something to change. I don't see that happening.
I think people just need to look at the duration of history's longest wars and compare them. Look at how long a settlement like Malatokmachka has held out, and look at how it looks now or used to look. It was never some heavily fortified fortress area. Once you see these obvious facts, the picture changes. Ukraine isn't losing. You don't stand firm for 5 years and consistently deal heavy blows to the second army in the world by losing.
The second army in Ukraine?
the Second Army in Ukraine. Absolutely. Unfortunately, they are still inside Ukraine for now.
In reality, we have already surpassed the duration of World War I in terms of timelines, and I believe we've passed
World War II?
World War II as well. That's according to the Russian point of view of timing. In Russian historical memory, World War II is often referred to as the Great Patriotic War, covering the period that lasted only 1,418 days. In fact, the Russians faced massive psychological apathy and depression during the winter because they calculated the exact number of days, and now their so-called SMO lasts longer. That figure has been crossed. We have been fighting longer than the entire span of their Great Patriotic War.
Well, the solution is simple. Make them take out their units, their people, and their weapons, and the war ends. To me, these are glaringly obvious facts. We need to remind people that it wasn't Ukrainian tanks that crossed the state border and invaded Russian territory. It was the exact opposite. A lot of people tend to forget that.
Yes, that is exactly how it is. Sometimes you just have to remind the world of these baseline facts and repeat that Russia is the sole aggressor. They invaded Ukraine expecting a quick walkover.
Kyiv in 3 days failed miserably, and so did Malatokmachka.
Yes, but look at where things stand. I don't know exactly when this episode will air, but as we speak right now, Moscow is facing widespread fuel shortages at its gas stations. So there you have it. If you are watching this video, please leave a comment, hit the like button, and ring the bell so you don't miss the next episode. All right, turning back to your time in captivity. Frankly, I don't bring up this topic with you or anyone else out of enthusiasm, but strictly because the world needs to know exactly what happens inside Russian prisons and that this isn't an isolated incident, but a widespread systemic phenomenon. For that reason, I have to ask you a bit about how you survived those 2.5 years in Russian hands. Let's start with this. On a scale of 1 to 10, how difficult was it for you personally?
For me personally? Well, probably a 9 or a 9.5, somewhere around there.
Right on the verge of the absolute maximum?
Yes, there were moments when it felt like an 11 out of 10. That happened several times, particularly during interrogations. During one session that lasted for 6 consecutive hours, you can imagine the state I was in. I repeatedly begged them to end it all by taking my life. Looking back now, I realize it's behind me, but those moments were very real. Or simply when you're standing inside your cell in solitary confinement and you just don't know what to do anymore. You stand there and use every internal mechanism available to force yourself to keep fighting.
Is it even possible to prepare for something like that?
I don't think you can prepare for it. For instance, you know, when a country like Belgium or any other European nation builds a prisoner of war camp, they do it strictly in accordance with the Geneva Conventions and international treaties, prioritizing human rights above all else. Frankly, if Russians were ever held in a place like that, they would probably never want to leave.
They certainly leave our facilities looking well-fed and resentful.
Exactly. Faces as round as absolute pumpkins. But in Russia, there is absolutely nothing like that. It mirrors historical concentration camps. I remember reading Viktor Frankl's Man's Search for Meaning. Reading that book, about 80% of it directly overlapped with my experience, the starvation, the harsh conditions, the daily survival, and how people just perish. To me, it felt like pure surrealism, the realities of 1939 and 1945 repeating themselves in 2024. How is that even possible? So no one should harbor any illusions about this. However, there is basic military training, both for officers and enlisted personnel. Different units handle different missions, and their training matches those demands. There is also baseline knowledge about captivity, how it is supposed to work and how it operates under the Ukrainian system. We actually adapted our protocols slightly from American and Israeli frameworks, and it evolved naturally because it is the most logical approach. First and foremost, your objective is to survive. You are permitted to share information with the enemy if withholding it directly poses an immediate threat to your life, your physical integrity, or the lives and safety of your fellow servicemen and women. That is a vital distinction. If you can safely conceal information, do so. If you can't, preserve your life. Beyond that, it's about organizational accountability. If a soldier knows more than necessary, information that could theoretically be exploited in captivity, managing that risk is the commander's responsibility, not the burden of the Marine sergeant or private, and that's how the system is structured. Of course, no one intends to surrender. General physical and psychological conditioning is what keeps you going, but no amount of basic training can truly prepare you to endure years in captivity. Tragically, my brothers in arms captured after the fall of Mariupol, have been sitting there for 4 years now. Training alone won't get you through that. It comes down to spirit. I always say, train and forge your spirit, because it will always outlast the body.
Do you think if an international viewer, say, someone living in Germany or any other country outside Ukraine, watches this interview and hears what you endured, it will demoralize them, or could it help them prepare mentally for what they might face?
I honestly don't know. It depends entirely on how a person handles raw truth. It's all down to individual perception. Naturally, it can terrify or demotivate someone. Or conversely, they might analyze it, dissect it, and draw valuable insights for themselves. It varies by individual. Personally, it would have helped me. I would have taken note of what works, what doesn't, or simply analyzed how another person handled it to map out my own choices.
Well, given the current mindset of the Russian population and their aggressive vision for the global order, I believe it is incredibly vital for Western audiences to watch our podcasts. They are completely raw. We present everything exactly as it is, without any sugarcoating or censorship. It hurts our metrics. It makes it much harder to beat the algorithms on YouTube and other platforms because we use the exact language that exists within those prison walls, but it remains crucial. People need to discover how it unfolds in reality rather than what is written on a piece of paper. You mentioned the camp standards being built in Europe and Viktor Frankl's book on the search for meaning. I've read it too and found the topic fascinating. One parallel I noticed was that severe starvation existed in both eras. However, I didn't see anything in his book about the kind of systematic daily beatings that Ukrainians are subjected to in modern Russia. You guys were getting pummeled every single day, whereas his account doesn't describe them being systematically beaten on a daily basis. Starvation, gas chambers, executions, yes, but the relentless daily physical abuse as a standard routine was something I didn't find in his text.
That is an incredibly profound observation, and I noticed it too. Westerners living in a peaceful, stable society, and thank God for that, may it always remain so, cannot evaluate Russia, Putin, their military commanders, or their decision makers through the lens of traditional Western politics. The same applies to the Russian population as a whole, who are undeniable accomplices in every war crime from Bucha to the present day. You cannot assess these individuals or entities through traditional political analysis or view them as standard rational actors. Why? Because I am deeply convinced that this assessment should be conducted exclusively by professional psychotherapists, psychiatrists, and intelligence services. Only that kind of clinical raw analysis will come close to the truth. Only after digesting that reality can one begin to comprehend why this happens, why certain horrors from the days of Nazi Germany are repeating themselves today, completely unlearned, ignored, and in some aspects even worse.
Another historical parallel that I recently learned about is how during World War II, the Germans maintained a significantly better standard of treatment toward British and French POWs. Consequently, Britain and France treated German POWs better because the Geneva Convention was active and mutually respected between them. The Soviet Union, however, refused to adhere to the Geneva Conventions. In response, Germany discarded the rules entirely on the Eastern Front. For our grandfathers and great-grandfathers, being in a German concentration camp was a brutal, fatal ordeal, whereas British and French prisoners could often receive letters and Red Cross care packages. Ultimately, we see a mirror of that reality today. Russian POWs in Ukrainian custody can correspond with their families and receive packages from home, while our personnel in Russia receive absolutely nothing. Is that fair?
Well, fairness is a philosophical question. I simply believe we must strive to uphold it regardless. The issue isn't just about abstract fairness, it's about defining who we are and what we are fighting for. If we are defending democratic values and ideals, as one analyst put it, Ukraine is the literal face of global democracy right now. If we are spilling our blood for this, we cannot allow ourselves to compromise on basic human decency, even in how we treat prisoners of war. We used to discuss this very topic with the guys in our cell. You would crawl back after a morning in inspection or a brutal interrogation covered in deep bruises, hands and head swollen, barely able to walk, completely emaciated. You'd sit there with your cellmates, one eye swollen shut from a hematoma, and talk. I remember those conversations vividly. We would say, guys, when we finally make it back to Ukraine and find out how the Russian POWs were treated, it absolutely must be entirely different. It must strictly follow the Geneva Convention. We refused to sink to the level of the monsters running those prisons in Russia. We deeply wanted our country to remain civilized. When we finally returned, I saw firsthand how their prisoners are kept. I have friends who visited the Ukrainian POW camps to inspect their living conditions. They have old spice deodorant on their shelves, 5 or 6 books neatly lined up, candy, personal packages, clean clothing, regular outdoor recreation, and constant phone access to their families. I won't say I felt bitter, but rather took pride in the fact that Ukraine maintains its moral superiority. We remain a cut above, despite how agonizing it is to see the skeletal state of returning Ukrainian prisoners, the torture they endured, and how many of our people perished from beatings, starvation, and medical neglect. Despite that agony, we must never sink to their level because we simply cannot afford to lose our humanity.
You mentioned Old Spice.
Not a paid endorsement, I swear.
No, I get it. My point is, over those 2.5 years, how much of that time did you actually have a toothbrush and toothpaste?
Toothpaste, if you combine all the scattered periods, maybe 6 months total, a toothbrush, perhaps 4 months for the remainder of the time, your toothbrush was your own finger.
Just a bare finger. That highlights the stark contrast in conditions.
The same goes for soap. A simple bar of soap was an absolute luxury, a highly prized commodity.
Which specific prisons did you pass through?
I was held in Sartana, Donetsk, Olenivka, Taganrog, Novozibkov in the Bryansk region, Kursk, and finally in the Republic of Mordovia at a settlement called Udarne, built right on the foundations of the old Soviet gulags. I actually feel a strange sense of solemn pride, knowing I was held in the same penal colony where our legendary Ukrainian poet and dissident, Vasil Stus, was imprisoned.
Hearing you list those names brings back immediate horrific imagery from my interviews with other survivors. It sounds like you drew a literal royal flush of the absolute worst penal facilities in the entire Russian system.
Every single intake process was a nightmare. In every new location, they find a distinct way to manifest their hatred, leaving you convinced you've hit the absolute rock bottom of human cruelty. Then you get transferred and you think, no, this is the worst place on earth. Then you move again and realize the previous one was actually tamer. It was a relentless cycle of transfers, brutal processing, and violent introductions to the guard staffs.
How did you mentally endure all of this? How did you carry that burden?
I honestly don't fully know. My ultimate anchor was my wife, my family, and a fierce desire to survive. It's an innate instinct. You simply refuse to give up. Did thoughts of suicide cross my mind? I won't lie, they did. Those thoughts inevitably flash through your head given the sheer weight of the environment, but you learn to swat them away immediately, dropping them like a burning ember that landed on your skin. You tell yourself, no, I will keep fighting, no matter what. And you hold on to the certainty that it will eventually end. Every single night is followed by a morning. A university classmate of mine, a Muslim, told me something that stuck with me for life. After every dark night, the sun must rise. Light will return and things will be okay. Eventually it will end. Either I will die here, they will kill me, and the suffering stops, or I will get exchanged. That keeps you tethered to reality. You dream, you think, and you live from one crust of bread to the next. Literally. Bread rotation was an actual milestone. Today you get the crust, and your next turn for a crust comes 5 days later. You survive by measuring time from crust to crust.
Was the crust considered better than a standard slice?
Yes, because it, I don't know, it just had a distinct, richer taste. You know how it is in childhood when your parents send you to buy a loaf of fresh bread? You walk home and gnaw off all the crusts because they're the best part. It was the exact same feeling there.
What can a person even dream about while trapped inside a Russian prison cell?
Absolutely everything. First and foremost, you map out exactly what you will do the moment you return home. You replay the best memories of your life and imagine how you can expand on them. You plan trips. In my mind, my wife and I traveled to every destination imaginable. I explored the entire world, flew into space, skydove from every altitude using every type of parachute, and kayaked every wild river I could think of or had ever seen on television. I won tournaments I could potentially compete in, visualizing every detail of the performance, and that's how you occupy your mind. And, of course, books. Whenever we managed to get our hands on literature, it acted as the ultimate sedative, because the moment you immerse yourself in a book, provided it wasn't a red book, since we flatly refused to touch those, a red book refers to Soviet propaganda, accounts of the Red Terror, the victorious Red Army, Lenin, and the Bolshevik Revolution. We would look at those and immediately toss them aside. Actually, when I had the strength, I used to stack those propaganda books on the floor and use them as blocks for deficit push-ups to get a deeper muscle stretch. That was the only useful purpose they served.
On a scale of 1 to 10, how intensely did the sensation of chronic hunger haunt you over those 2.5 years?
A 10, easily an 11, no doubts. Starvation is one of the foundational pillars upon which the entire Russian system of abusing Ukrainian prisoners rests. It is a core tactic, endless gnawing hunger.
Did the ordinary Russian convicts, the actual criminal inmates, eat better than the Ukrainian prisoners?
They can earn wages and receive commissary packages. I was held in a block adjacent to regular Russian inmates, so I saw how they were fed. They could afford to be picky, choosing what to eat, leaving food behind, demanding extra portions, adding sugar to their tea. Their families sent them regular care packages. They could smoke inside their cells, and they had full access to books. It wasn't just slightly better. If I had been fed the way those criminals were, I would say, I never experienced hunger a single day in prison. It was a completely different tier of treatment.
So, in essence, the Russian state shows higher regard for its own violent criminals than for Ukrainian citizens who have zero criminal background, many of whom are simply mobilized IT professionals, teachers, or average citizens.
The hypocrisy is utterly surreal. When I was being transferred to Mordovia, I traveled in a specialized prison rail car. I was placed in a solitary barred compartment entirely by myself. In the adjacent compartment, they were transporting a man in his late 40s who was serving a 17-year sentence for the rape of a minor. The guards, walking up and down the corridor, treated this man with shocking deference, asking if he needed hot water, bringing him matches, offering him fresh tea. They were practically catering to him like waiters. Meanwhile, I'm sitting there alone, a person who had spent 2 years in captivity solely for defending his homeland on his own sovereign soil when his country faced invasion. Whenever a guard approached my cage, it was pure hostility. Shut your mouth, drop your head, look at me again and see what happens. Step within half a meter of the bars and I'll come in there and break you. You are forced to cower in the furthest corner of the cage just to avoid a beating. That was their attitude toward a defender of Ukraine. And right through a 20-centimeter wall sits a convicted child rapist being asked if his tea is warm enough. How do you even process that? It is a total inversion of basic human values.
It exposes a civilizational chasm between Ukrainians and Russians, a chasm that many in the Western world stubbornly refuse to recognize or comprehend. Most people prefer not to look too deeply into it. It's uncomfortable. Only a select few truly grasp it. How do we effectively explain to Western society that this isn't a mere political dispute, but a profound civilizational fracture, and that peaceful coexistence feels entirely impossible?
The divide is truly monumental. We were never brotherly nations. Historically, we have simply been neighbors and often bitter ones. Centuries ago, when Ukrainian royalty like Queen Anne of France was literate and deeply cultured, Moscow was literally still a swamp. We didn't choose our geography, but the cultural, mental, and ethical chasm between us is vast. Look at the Ukrainian reverence for labor, for building something beautiful and orderly. Visit a typical Ukrainian village and then look at a rural Russian settlement. They are two entirely different worlds. A Ukrainian village represents generations of relentless pride and hard work, waking up at 4 or 5 in the morning to tend to livestock and working until dusk. Then look at the Russian village. I saw them through the barred windows of the prison train and it shocked me. In a country that boasts of being a global energy superpower, 60% to 70% of their rural villages lack basic gas lines or running water. That tells you everything you need to know. Ukraine is historically a nation of free, independent farmers. But if you march onto our land with a sword, we will readily show you that a sickle isn't just used for harvesting wheat.
Returning to the topic of food, can you describe the daily prison rations? Well, what was the single most delicious thing you managed to taste over those 30 months?
The most delicious thing is burned into my memory forever. It happened in Mordovia. There was a Russian inmate working as a balander, the trustee responsible for distributing food rations. He was a few days away from completing his sentence. He was in his 50s, but had spent 26 of those years inside various prisons. He was a seasoned convict about to walk free. One evening, he brought over a plastic bag hidden inside a sack. Inside was bread that had been fried in cooking oil, just plain stale bread fried in oil. Apparently some leftovers had turned hard, so the kitchen staff fried them up, but the Russian convicts rejected them. This trustee took the bag and secretly distributed the pieces to the Ukrainian prisoners. It was a tiny slice of bread, cut from a standard loaf, no thicker than a finger. To this day, it remains the most exquisite thing I have ever tasted. Nothing else even came close. I remember that moment with absolute clarity. It felt truly divine. The standard daily routine consisted of breakfast, lunch, and dinner, though they skipped meals on occasion. Breakfast was invariably a watery mush. They used a standard 300 or 400 gram metal bowl, but they never filled it. Some guys tried combining their entire day's ration into a single bowl, and it barely filled half or two-thirds of the container. That was the entire allotment for a grown man standing 6 feet tall, who weighed 180 or 200 pounds before capture. The food was entirely devoid of salt, oil, or fat. Just grains boiled in plain water. Breakfast was literally a spoonful or two of mush spread so thinly across the plate it looked like a puddle. Lunch varied, but it usually featured what they called soup, which was essentially hot water with cabbage. Russian cuisine is obsessed with cabbage, shchi, stews, everything revolves around it. It was just murky water with a couple of stray cabbage leaves floating inside. That was their excuse for a hearty meal. It highlights another massive cultural divide, our rich borscht versus their bland shchi.
Shchi is essentially just the discarded water from a real soup.
Exactly. Honestly, if you left nothing but the broth of a real Ukrainian borscht, it would still be a feast compared to their shchi. Theirs was just hot water cabbage leaves and a foul odor. Dinner was another scoop of watery mush, sometimes accompanied by what was supposed to be fish. Now, in reality, it was just the crushed spines of tiny bait fish or scraps of unidentifiable sea life. Over those 2.5 years, neither I nor any of the guys in my cell ever left a single fish bone behind. The hunger is so agonizing and relentless that you chew on every single bone, even the sharpest ones not meant for consumption. You grind them down thoroughly with your teeth like a straight dog and swallow them because there is absolutely nothing else. You consume every scrap. The fish was always overboiled, rotting, and smelled putrid. But in those conditions, your brain completely bypasses disgust. Occasionally, they served potatoes for dinner. But what is a potato to a Ukrainian? It implies garlic, fresh oil, cracklings, and care. We could turn this into an endless culinary discussion, but their potatoes were just small, unpeeled chunks, completely unseasoned, served in tiny portions. Furthermore, about 60% of the time, the potatoes were completely spoiled and sour. In Taganrog, the dinner potatoes and morning mush were consistently sour. The reason is simple. They never cleaned the large industrial vats used to transport the food. Today's ration routinely contains the rotting residue of yesterday's meal. Frankly, a farm pig or a stray dog in Ukraine eats significantly better than a Ukrainian prisoner of war in Russia. That is the absolute undeniable truth. That is the fuel you are given to try to survive and keep your sanity.
How much weight did you lose overall?
Around 35 kilograms, 77 pounds. I weighed 95 kilograms when I was captured, and when I returned, I was down to barely 60. I was a literal walking skeleton.
What about psychological warfare? Did they force you to listen to specific songs or attend propaganda lectures?
The psychological coercion is constant and inescapable. They hammer the same lies into your head every day. Ukraine no longer exists. Your government will collapse by tomorrow. In 2 weeks, your families in Kharkiv will be under Russian rule. Europe has completely abandoned you. You are entirely on your own, and Zelensky has sold you. Out. They have an intense pathological hatred for Zelensky. Then there is the music, blasted through loudspeakers for 16 hours every single day. Imagine turning on music so loud that it completely drowns out your ability to hear your own internal thoughts, and it never stops. 16 hours a day, entirely uninterrupted. The track list consists exclusively of Soviet military marches, tracks about great victories, songs glorifying turning the West into nuclear ash, and anthems about reclaiming Alaska.
Were these claims actually produced in professional songs, or was it just audio from radio commentators and lecturers?
No, these were literal produced songs. They sang about conquering Alaska, settling old scores with the Japanese, and launching invasions into Finland and the Baltic states. During interrogations, the operatives constantly push these geopolitical delusions, and if you have tattoos, it triggers extreme violence. The moment they spot a Ukrainian trizub, the trident, things turn brutal. They subject you to horrific physical abuse while screaming that it is a Nazi symbol. To them, Our national coat of arms is pure contraband.
Did you ever try to explain the history to them?
Inside St. Peter's Basilica in the Vatican, there is a prominent monument to Prince Volodymyr the Great, the ruler who Christianized Kievan Rus. He is depicted holding the trizub, so by their logic, a medieval saint is carved inside the heart of the Vatican holding a Nazi symbol. Just a helpful historical fact for anyone unaware.
He clearly anticipated that a political movement 1,000 years later would adopt his family crest.
Exactly. He designed it specifically for them a millennium in advance, so now it's branded as Nazi, simply because it's the Ukrainian trident.
Let me summarize this point for context. The trizub isn't merely the modern coat of arms of the Ukrainian state, it is a sacred symbol with over 1,000 years of documented history. Vladimir the Great and the earliest rulers of Rusya utilized it as their personal royal stamp. Historically, it is a stylized depiction of a falcon diving down upon its prey, though interpretations vary. The core fact remains, this symbol is over 10 centuries old, yet modern Russian propaganda brands it as Nazi simply because they decreed it so. There is zero historical literacy behind it.
They don't seek facts, they simply assign labels. It's the easiest path, decree that the trident is evil, and the narrative is set. In reality, it has a millennium of rich history preserved and passed down through generations on our land. It was utilized by the Kingdom of Galicia-Volhynia and later by the Ukrainian Cossack state. They analyzed it, gave it deep philosophical meaning, and cherished it. For us, it represents our oldest roots. How they connect that to 20th century Nazism is a mystery only their propagandists can explain.
Did they actively attempt to force you to assimilate or defect?
Constantly, they repeatedly pressured us to give up, saying, Yaltashov signed the paperwork, accept Russian citizenship, you have nothing left to return to anyway, your cities are gone. If you go back in an exchange, your own government will put you on trial as traitors. Your president has already written you off. Along with the verbal pressure, we were forced to memorize Russian nationalistic poetry and sing their national anthem dozens of times a day. They demanded we know the exact number of characters and punctuation marks in the Russian anthem and how every stanza begins. Ironically, the guards themselves didn't know these details, but we were beaten if we slipped up. They also forced us to memorize bizarre religious prayers for the protection of the Russian soldier. The sheer absurdity of it was mind-boggling.
In a previous interview, David Prachenko mentioned that along with the propaganda music, the camp authorities forced them to watch videos by Patrick Lancaster, an American who produces pro-Kremlin propaganda content in the occupied territories. Did you encounter his material?
They forced us to watch various propaganda broadcasts. I don't know if his specific content was featured, but they frequently played a documentary titled The Truth About Bandera, as well as a heavily fabricated film about the siege of Mariupol. Watching that was deeply surreal and infuriating. I had spent the entire siege inside Mariupol, fighting alongside the civilian population and helping them survive. We lived through every second of it. Hearing their documentary rewrite those events felt like listening to a transmission from an alternate inverted universe. It filled us with pure disgust. Whenever those specific video blocks aired, you eventually get used to the background music, which actually helps you keep track of time when you're forced to pace. But when those propaganda films came on, we called it pure vomit. It was a visceral, sickening experience to sit there and listen to them explain the truth about Ukrainian history and our units.
Stepan Bandera and historical units belong to past centuries, but Mariupol was a reality you witnessed with your own eyes. You saw the raw truth, yet they forced you to listen to a narrative that claimed the exact opposite occurred.
Everything was completely inverted. They found some random actress to provide a dramatic voiceover, claiming Ukrainian forces systematically executed civilians. Then they showed an elderly man making an absolutely hilarious claim. Judging by his voice, he was quite old. And he stated that Ukrainian troops would drive a Kras truck carrying a heavy 120mm mortar up to a civilian nine-story apartment building. Anyone with basic military knowledge can look up the literal weight of a 120mm mortar. He claimed our soldiers hauled this massive multi-100-pound artillery piece up the stairs onto the roof of a nine-story building because the view was better from up there, and then used it to shell the civilians living below. Even if he had claimed it was a light 60mm mortar, it would still be a military absurdity. Carrying a heavy mortar to a rooftop makes zero operational sense. It's physically impossible to operate from there without destroying the structural slab beneath you. Yet he dramatically detailed how we hauled it up flights of stairs to slaughter our own people. And you are forced to sit there and listen to this trash while remembering the literal sight of Russian jets flattening apartment complexes right in front of your eyes, and Russian artillery opening fire on clearly marked civilian evacuation corridors. Hearing their lies was deeply, profoundly agonizing.
Hearing you describe this triggers a very familiar anger in me. I encounter this exact brand of disinformation when browsing European news outlets or reading pro-Russian comments on international platforms. It baffles me how this toxic garbage manages to penetrate Western societies and find a receptive audience. Just a few days ago, a colleague sent me a link to a Czech alternative media outlet. I think it was called CZ24.news or something similar. Out of curiosity, I fed several articles into an AI model and asked it to extract the three core arguments of the piece, because it was obviously a pro-Kremlin influence operation. The model pulled the following points. Ukraine has already lost the war. European financial and military aid to Ukraine is actively destroying the European economy, and defeating Russia militarily is an absolute impossibility. I sat there thinking, wow, I've heard these exact talking points somewhere before. Perhaps you can tell me where these narratives originate?
They originate directly inside Russia. They manufacture them, fund them, and blast them globally. Tragically, Russia has sympathizers not just in Europe, but across the entire globe. Realistically, this will always be a factor. Let's not forget that Nazi Germany had active supporters and apologists deep inside Western democracies before and during World War II, not just within the Axis borders.
I sincerely hope the average Czech citizen isn't a sympathizer of a totalitarian Russia, yet these proxy websites continue to operate and spread their poison under the guise of local media.
Those sites operate because democratic societies value freedom of speech and...
Exactly, that is their standard defense. We have freedom of speech. What I tell them, freedom of speech has absolutely nothing to do with a hostile hybrid warfare campaign being waged against your society. This is a direct implementation of the Gerasimov Doctrine, which explicitly outlines how to subvert target populations through information operations. This isn't a free speech issue.
Absolutely, and that is the core of the tragedy. Western societies know next to nothing about the mechanics of hybrid warfare and gray zone operations, or rather, they know far too little, far too late. They are learning their lessons at a painfully slow pace while the threat evolves. They react slowly, delay critical security decisions, and drop the ball. This isn't about maintaining liberal tolerance. It's a matter of basic national survival for individual European states and the security of the Euro-Atlantic Alliance as a whole. They need to wake up and take decisive action.
That reality is precisely why I founded this podcast, to pierce through the abstract geopolitical noise by sharing the raw, verified stories of individuals who survived the system. It allows viewers to piece together the broader puzzle and realize that a Russian ballet performance in Berlin isn't just about art. It's an intentional psychological operation designed to lull European audiences into a false sense of security, making them think, oh, Russia is cultured and refined. They gave the world Tolstoy. We shouldn't view them as a threat. To put it bluntly, it's a trap. The entire concept of a supremacist Russian culture is a manufactured myth. No other civilization constantly beats its chest, demanding to be recognized as uniquely great. Yet everything in Russia must bear that label. I remember reading Dostoevsky's Crime and Punishment. By the halfway mark, the sheer pretentiousness made me physically nauseous, and I left it unfinished. That's incredibly rare for me because I always finish books. The prose is profoundly tedious. It's not an exploration of high morality, but a celebration of primitive, base cruelty masquerading as deep philosophy. It normalizes a primitive mindset, while the Western intellectual tradition overanalyzes it, inventing grand, complex motives to justify a basic, sordid murder, fantasizing about a hidden genius that simply isn't there.
That is exactly where the danger lies. When a Russian ballet performs in Berlin, it allows people to indulge in the naive illusion that culture is completely separate from politics. They argue we must preserve ties with Russian culture, entirely blind to the fact that their cultural exports serve as a direct delivery mechanism for imperialistic narratives, operating exactly like the Kremlin-controlled Russian Orthodox Church.